Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. An hour and a half north of Sacramento, east along the Feather River, sits the tallest dam in the country, Oroville Dam, the length of 2.5 football fields high. Its reservoir is the second largest surface reservoir in California, behind Shasta Lake. This human feat of engineering is responsible for delivering water throughout the San Joaquin Valley in Southern California, hydroelectricity, flood control, and recreation. And 5 years ago today, Oroville Dam showed its vulnerability in an awe-terrifying way. A crater-sized crack in the middle of the primary spillway and potential failure of the adjoining emergency spillway threatened 188,000 residents downstream. I covered this for weeks on end and remember the miles of parking lot vehicles slowly rushing to evacuate, the moments of quick decision-making amid gravity and uncertainty. Today, Oroville Dam and its spillways have been reconstructed and are stronger, but we're going to revisit what happened, what went wrong, the hard learning lessons, and rebuilding trust. Our first guest is Butte County Sheriff Corey Honey. Sheriff Honey has guided this North State community through some of the worst crises and disasters in the state, from Oroville Dam spillway to the campfire, the North Complex fire, more than most in his position face in their entire career.
Sheriff Honey, events where hours run into days, become weeks with little sleep are far from foreign to you. You have been the sheriff of Butte County for nearly 8 years. In that time, your community has been front and center of some of the worst crises in California and arguably the country. You've been with the sheriff's department, however, for just shy of 30 years. But the timing of you becoming sheriff is quite extraordinary. Do you see it that way?
Well, I will definitely tell you that when I contemplated running for sheriff, I certainly never thought that I would end up dealing with the number of major incidents that I've dealt with. Certainly, I've been blessed to have a department that rises to the occasion during crisis and is able to perform at a very high level. Also blessed to have a community that is very supportive of our efforts. But definitely, when I look back at the tenure of my predecessors, they didn't have nearly as many events to deal with as I have had to. It has been an interesting ride, to say the least.
To say the least. 5 years ago, the Oroville spillway crisis began, tallest dam in the country, right in your backyard. Of all the emergencies you were prepared to respond to, did Lake Oroville, the dam, and the spillway ever cross your mind?
You know, in all honesty, prior to the Oroville Dam spillway incident, I was generally aware of the fact there was a dam in Butte County. Certainly knew that, created Lake Oroville. But beyond that, I certainly had not given it any thought whatsoever. And I have to admit that I wasn't even aware of the fact that it was the tallest dam in the United States, which is a pretty amazing thing right here in Butte County. When you prepare for a career in law enforcement, the topic of how dams work and how they could fail, not covered at all in the police academy. And when you become a new sheriff, you go to a week-long new sheriff school. And I can tell you that when I went through there, nobody said anything about dams and what could happen if there was a problem at one of them. So it was something that really wasn't on my radar prior to this event.
Take us back to when you first learned there was a problem. What was your initial reaction when you saw the size of a crater on the primary spillway?
That was on February 7th. And, you know, interestingly enough, I remember I was having a meeting with the CAO of the county, and we were talking about budgets, which is one of the more mundane tasks that sheriffs end up having to deal with. And I got a text message from local individual in the media here in Butte County and asked me if I had heard about a problem at the dam. And at that point, I hadn't. And so I asked my assistant to call over to our dispatch center to find out if we had received a call indicating there was a problem. She did call our dispatch center. And what she was told was that we had received a recorded message from the Department of Water Resources indicating that there was some kind of either routine maintenance or some other term that didn't really describe what was going on. And so I contacted that individual back and said, no, it doesn't appear that anything's going on. And it was about that same time, another staff member brought me her cell phone and showed me a picture that had been posted on Facebook of the spillway with that massive crater that you were talking about. And when I looked at that, I certainly thought to myself, well, that doesn't look routine. But I really didn't at that moment understand what the threat to our community was. And it was at that moment that I kind of began this whole effort over the course of the next couple of days to understand what the threat was, and also to understand, you know, how the dam operated and what importance it had in the California State Water Project. So it was a steep learning curve, to say the least.
Yeah, really. I mean, so much unfolded in the first days of this crisis. For one, the emergency spillway, which is adjacent to the primary spillway, was used for the first time in Oroville Dam's 50-year history. What were some of the thoughts and emotions as you watched that volume of water just pour over the emergency spillway that day?
You know, leading up to that, I had to work really hard to make inroads into the Department of Water Resources. It's a state agency. It's a large agency. Certainly at that time, there was, you know, there's a lot of bureaucracy in large agencies, and that's something you have to move through. They weren't, I think, prepared to manage a crisis on this scale. And so there was frustration leading up to that point. Number one, trying to understand what the threat to the community was, but also understanding, you know, who I could talk to in the organization. And I will tell you that I had some tense conversations with members of the Department of Water Resources, including the then director, Bill Croyle. But after we initially met and he understood what my concerns were, which was protecting his community, and his concerns aligned with mine, we became good allies. And he is somebody that I respect. And he played a critical role in keeping our community safe the day that the flood control outlet began to erode. Leading up to that, as the water was coming over, and you know, they were telling me that this is the first time that this has ever happened. And what I was left with, or basically the message that I was receiving, was this isn't ideal. This isn't great. But we think it's going to be okay, or we think that, you know, we're going to be able to make it through. And so I was moving into February 12th with this idea that, well, this is not the best case scenario, but that's what this part of the dam was designed to do. And so it's looking okay for now.
You were the one who ultimately made the call to evacuate eventually some 180,000 residents living along the Feather River at a time when the risk and the threat was still being assessed by state officials. Knowing what we know now with 5 years of hindsight, it's easy to take that decision for granted. Was there a specific piece of information that led you to make that call?
Yeah, that was based ultimately on a couple of different conversations that took place in a rather short span of time. On that particular day, again, it was February 12th. You know, interestingly enough, it was a sunny Sunday afternoon. The emergency spillway water had been had crested it and was, you know, pouring down the side of the mountain. But by all indications, all of the information I was receiving from DWR was, again, this is not ideal, but things are going the way that it was designed. And so I had been working many, many hours and a number of days and hadn't been home and hadn't slept much. And so I said, well, I think I'm going to go home for the afternoon. And as I was going around the room, talking to people, letting them know that I was going to be leaving, but I'd have a staff member there, I heard one of the DWR officials, another, you know, very good, well-intentioned individual. He was looking at a photograph of the emergency spillway. And as I approached, I heard him say, does the sheriff know about this? And then that obviously piqued my interest. And I said, what? And he started pointing to what was head cutting or erosion. And he pointed to it and he said, right here, sheriff, this right here, pointing to the erosion. And I said, well, what is that? And he said, well, it's head cutting. And again, I'm not an expert in this. And I said, well, what does that mean? And he said, well, we need to go talk about it. And so he and a whole group of other people, subject matter experts, went and talked about it. When they came back, though, I sensed real alarm, real concern. And I began to question them about what the possibilities were. And through that questioning, the scenario that was proffered was that if the erosion made it all the way back to the emergency spillway, that concrete weir, that it could undermine it, causing it to topple, and then the water would pour out behind it. And when I asked if that could result in loss of life, the response was yes, it could. And then I asked, well, how fast is it traveling? And they said I believe it was about 20 feet an hour. And I said, well, how close is it? And they said, it's about 20 feet away. So, maybe it's about 30 feet an hour, 30 feet away. But the bottom line is,
you didn't have a lot of time. To make that decision, basically. You're running against the clock.
And so real quickly, I recapped to the room of subject matter experts what I had heard, what I understood, and asked if I was misunderstanding anything. And of course, no one corrected that or indicated that I was misunderstanding. And at that point, I said, it seems like I'm going to have to order the evacuation. If anybody's got a better idea or thinks that's wrong, speak up now. Tell me now. And the room was silent. And it was at that point that I realized that I had to make that order and did so.
When you reflect on that evacuation, what went well and what were some of the hard learning lessons?
Well, you know, interestingly, right after I made that order, I made a couple of other orders. And one of them was I turned to the captain from the sheriff's office that was in the room with me. And I said, get a hold of our dispatch center and tell them that they need to evacuate, because I was concerned that they would be within the flood inundation zone. And I knew that if we lost the ability to communicate, we were going to be in much, much worse trouble with regard to managing the evacuation. I think that was a good decision. And I think that went very, very well. And I'm glad we made that decision. Secondly, I ordered the evacuation of the jail. We couldn't open the doors and let the people that we had in custody out, but I also couldn't leave them there with the prospect that they would perish if the water got there. And so that was a good decision, but that was a very, very difficult operation. The last thing that I said was call all of our staff members and tell them to come in and help with this. And as soon as I said that, I was immediately hit with the understanding or the impact of that order, which was I had just called for all of my staff members to come into a place that I was telling everybody else to leave because I was afraid that there was a threat to human life. And I remember thinking to myself that if I have a department tomorrow, I might not have anybody working for me.
Wow. In the days that followed, in the midst of all that, you and state officials were providing daily press briefings. I personally was there every day going up there. I'm very familiar with that area. But I'm curious, are you able to shed some light on the meetings that were taking place? And were there some conversations that were being had that stick with you to this day?
You know, there were lots of meetings. There was so many issues, so many concerns. And even through that, there was a constant effort to really understand what we were dealing with and what the threat to the community was. The other thing that I learned from that incident and actually probably prepared me for other incidents that I had to deal with beyond that was that the moment that you order an evacuation, there is immediate pressure on you to let people back in. And even when it's not yet safe to do so. And so there were lots of meetings as soon as that order was given and the evacuation took place. And it was chaotic and it was frightening. But once we got everybody out, then there was the pressure to let them in. And so there was a lot of conversation about when is this going to be safe to let people in. And, you know, that's where I got to give credit again to Director Bill Croyle. He took his team and began to work at ensuring that the potential failure that we were concerned about didn't happen by pushing more water down the damaged flood control outlet. Him and his crew saved the Hyatt Powerhouse. And then there was this immediate effort to start fortifying the side of that mountain so that the pressure on the back of that wall wouldn't cause it. So his work in that regard, their work in that regard probably wasn't as visible as the work that we were doing, but it was as critical.
And if you go back to Bill Croyle, he had just became the acting director for Department of Water Resources. And then after this crisis, he retired like that summer. So it's crazy how both of you were thrust into this. And now I'm learning the two of you were allies.
Oh, absolutely. Obviously, when you have a relationship that is born in crisis, once you realize that you're dealing with an individual who cares about what he's doing, cares about, people, I found that we had the same goal ultimately. And that is a friendship that I think will endure. He is somebody that I respect, and I'm glad that he was where he was in that position at the time, because I'm not confident that I would have been able to work well with other people if they didn't have the same viewpoint.
I remember going back to, I just reread it, an Associated Press article. They obtained notes from an emergency meeting that happened in the first hours of the evacuation order. And you reportedly said, it's an ugly mess. And, and I'm saying this, very PC, but we're going to try to make the best out of it. And the reason why I bring that up is because it really encapsulates the gravity, but also the uncertainty of that moment.
Yeah. And I think I know the comment that you're referring to. And you saw me during press briefings. Sometimes I speak pretty plainly sometimes, and especially in meetings, I don't mince words. But you're right. It was a very, very, very difficult situation. We didn't want to be in it, but we didn't have a choice. And it was important that we do our best to lead our community through that. And I think at the end of the day, as difficult and chaotic and horrifying as that was, I think we were able to lead our community through that.
In a Q&A discussion you held just last September for a Rotary Club, you said that during the spillway incident, somehow you became the sheriff of all dams. Unpack that. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I became the sheriff or the dam sheriff. I'm not entirely sure. But, it was interesting. That incident, of course, garnered international attention. And we got certainly media requests, local, national, international. But beyond that, people would call my office from all over the world. Some of them had all kinds of ideas about how to fix the dam, and they wanted to talk to me about that. But I'm not the person who fixed dams. That would have been DWR's role. There was, in the aftermath of that, I got requests to go speak and lecture at various, locations and to various groups about how to manage those kinds of things. But there was, for that period of time, I was the sheriff of dams.
The reality is that wasn't the only crisis that you had to manage as sheriff. And you've classified Oroville as kind of a practice or a run through for the campfire, which ignited the year following the spillway crisis. How did that emergency prepare you and your department for what would become the deadliest and most destructive wildfire in California history? And unfortunately, not the only one since then in your county.
Yeah, that's a great question. And interestingly enough, I'm a person who always tries to see this positive in things or look for the silver lining. It's the best way I know how to move through crisis. And as that was going on, I honestly thought as we were coming to the end, we came to the spillway, I kind of foolishly said, this is probably the biggest disaster or the most significant thing that I will ever handle during my tenure as sheriff. And I would often say that, I wouldn't wish it upon anybody, but I'm glad that I went through it and had the experience of it. I don't think I really fully appreciated that until the campfire came around, because certainly the lessons that I learned, the lessons that my department learned, the lessons that our community learned came into play with regard to our response to the campfire. We had taken a look at how the evacuation went, and we implemented some emergency notification strategies that hadn't been in place prior to the spillway. I put together an internal incident management team so that we could, better manage crisis, and certainly never thinking that we'd manage anything bigger than the spillway. When the campfire happened, that incident was, significantly more complex and devastating than the spillway situation. And as you know, the fire moved so rapidly from where it started, by the time it got to Paris, I don't think that we would have been able to manage that response and that evacuation as well as we did. Not to say that we were perfect. I'm not suggesting at all, not to diminish or downplay the fact that, you know, 81 people lost their lives. But I think that if we hadn't had the experience of spillway, perhaps it could have been worse.
You're also a member of the community and a longtime member of the community. As DWR began repairing the spillway, it also began to work on restoring trust with Oroville and other communities along the Feather River. When you talk to people who live in Oroville, in your community, do they still express distrust with DWR? What are their concerns when it comes to safety with Oroville Dam? And what do you tell them? What kind of conversations do you have?
You're absolutely right. Leading up to spillway, there had been a fair amount of distrust within the community. The relationship between Butte County and DWR was, I think, best described as contentious. And after the spillway, or rather the spillway just exacerbated that. But there was an effort, and I think there continues to be an effort on the part of DWR, especially the DWR employees who live in this community, to build those bridges and mend those fences and reassure people. The spillway incident left a lasting scar on our community. And I suspect that for many, many years to come, there will be people who remember that day, like other significant events that collectively we all remember, 9/11, and, Pearl Harbor, if you're of that generation, that kind of thing. But I do think that, time has a way of helping and healing those wounds. And I think that there's been some progress made in that. But even today, almost 5 years later, I still have people come up to me in the community and talk about that day and relate to me what their experience was. And I always appreciate that. Oftentimes, we're able to share our common experiences. And so when I say earlier that I appreciate the support of my community, that's part of what I'm talking about. They still remember that and still are willing to come up and talk with me about it and express their gratitude, which in retrospect is an amazing thing, because I will tell you that on the day that I ordered the evacuation, I talked about the thought process I went through. There was a point in time where I began to question whether or not I had heard correctly what was being told to me. And I turned to the captain and I said, "Did they say that?" And he said, "Yeah, they said that." And there was some time when I thought, man, people are going to run me out of office for this. But that turned out not to be the case.
Yet here you are. And, you started off by saying that you kind of generally knew what Oroville Dam was and what, you're not a dam expert. And obviously you viewed it very differently 5 years ago when all this was unfolding. But I imagine now, 5 years later, does it mean something different to you when you look at Lake Oroville or the dam or the spillway and now a strengthened emergency spillway?
Yeah, that's a great question. So now whenever I am driving or flying, because I have occasion to fly in our helicopter, I notice that my eye will catch the dam and the spillway, whereas before I never paid any attention to it at all. It is something that I now am cognizant about, the fact that I look at it. When I'm in the air flying our helicopter, I don't fly when I'm being flown in our helicopter. Whenever we go by, I generally have them make a couple of passes around to make sure things are okay. But it has definitely left an indelible impression on me.
Finally, you've managed more crises and emergencies in 8 years than many in your field will face in their entire career. What motivates you to stick with it?
Well, that's a good question, too.
Because I think generally the community would understand if you wanted to take a break. I don't think anyone would fault you for it.
I appreciate that. It's funny, we talked about, yes, I became the sheriff of dams. And then since then, I think sometimes I worry that the community is going to think that I'm the sheriff of disaster. And none of these disasters happened before I became sheriff. And you begin to wonder, is it you or is it me? But that said, I keep doing it because there's still work to be done. And I feel, a sense of duty to try to get that done. I definitely look more now at what life in retirement will be than I did, before, but I still have work to do here. I still want to get our community better prepared for whatever crisis may come. I still want to get my department prepared for a time when when I'm not here and I can turn the reins over to somebody. And when that time comes, then I will go and do it, but it's not here yet.
And that is Butte County Sheriff Corey Honey reflecting on the emergency response decisions made on the five-year anniversary of the Oroville Dam spillway crisis. Up next, an Oroville Dam Citizens Advisory Commissioner shares her involvement in citizen oversight and where things stand with trust 5 years later. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're marking the fifth anniversary of the Oroville Dam spillway crisis with conversations with those who went through that day. I just finished a conversation with Butte County Sheriff Corey Honey about the quick decision-making amid emergency response. We touched upon the trust that eroded with the community and state water managers following the evacuation of nearly 200,000 people downstream along the Feather River. Since that crisis in 2017, the state created an Oroville Dam Citizens Advisory Commission so that the public can weigh in and take part in the operations, maintenance, and overall public safety. The majority of members are elected or government officials, but one is a private citizen appointed by the Butte County Board of Supervisors to represent and advocate for the needs of her community. That commissioner is Genoa Northern. Genoa, you're a third-generation Orovillian. What makes the town such a special place for you and your family and for the people who call Oroville home?
Well, it's close to everything. You know, we can get in the car and go to Sacramento, go to the big city, or drive up to the mountains just an hour or two to the snow in the winter, head to the beach if we want to in about 3 hours. But it still has that small-town feel. And you know, where everybody, we all grew up together. Everybody knows everyone else. The traffic's not bad.
Yeah, really. Before 2017, you know, I guess, what did Oroville Dam, the lake and the spillway mean for the community?
I think for most of the community, the major thing is the recreation. It's a beautiful place to spend the summer days up at the lake. A lot of the town enjoys walking across the dam in the evenings. Me and my family go biking up there a lot. It was really just a recreation spot mm-hmm. for most of us.
The people of Oroville had a complicated relationship or have a complicated relationship with the dam really ever since the construction was completed back in 1968. Some viewed it as a source of community pride. Others viewed it as disdain or even had some anger. You know, unpack that dichotomy between these opposing views in your town.
Yeah. I think that there were a lot of promises made by the state when the dam was built or was in the planning stages. It completely changed the economy of Oroville and the landscape of the river that runs right through downtown Oroville. And I think that was seen as a negative by a lot of the community. It was promised at the time to be state-of-the-art, completely safe, and that it would bring recreation from all over the state to Oroville and really just make it a safer and better place to live. And I don't think that those promises were followed through in a lot of ways. A lot of things changed since then, and a lot of the citizens felt they were lied to.
Oh, that leads me to 2017, when the safety of residents downstream or along the Feather River were put into jeopardy. We talked with Sheriff Corey Honey about the decision to evacuate 180,000 people. That number includes your family. I remember that time being chaotic as a reporter covering it, you know, with about, what, an hour's notice to flee. How did you navigate that stress, that fear, and that uncertainty?
Well, it's kind of a blur of panic, I guess, that was going on around me at the time, watching people, you know, running down the street. There were car accidents happening, people trying to get out. There were lines at all the gas stations because people were trying to fill up their tanks so that they could leave. And it was really scary. Luckily, you know, my family was all packed up and ready to go when the evacuation warning came out. But it was a terrifying experience for everybody, I think.
Yeah, and that's completely understandable. 5 years later, you've turned that experience to becoming an activist for your community. You're commissioner on the Oroville Dam Citizen Advisory Commission. And the goal of the commission is to restore trust that was broken, increase transparency between DWR and Feather River communities. Where does that relationship stand today?
I think that there's still a lot of distrust with the community. I can see a change for the better with the commission and the natural resources, the Department of Natural Resources being involved. It really has helped open up the line of communication between the Department of Water Resources and the community. And I see promise there.
When you talk about promise, what is that for you?
Transparency and having our voice heard as a community by the state in the decisions that they're making and the way that they're operating.
Knowing what you know now, given that you're part of an advisory commission that works with the state and works with the state Natural Resources Agency, how do you view that crisis? What happened in 2017 with that perspective and that knowledge?
That's a difficult one. There definitely was a lack of oversight, and there was a lack of accountability that was happening within the Department of Water Resources at that time. And I think it opened a lot of people's eyes, not just the citizens, but also with the department and with the state, that things needed to be looked into a little further. It was a complete disaster on their part as far as keeping up with maintenance and making sure that they were really doing everything that they could to keep the community safe.
This crisis garnered international attention, has been investigated, has been debated, has been reconstructed in the years since. But for you, what's missing from this conversation?
The biggest thing is, from the beginning, what I've always said is it's not just a spillway. That's the name of my Facebook page that I created shortly after the crisis, because my biggest worry at the time and still is that, you know, the same people and the same materials built the rest of a dam when the spillway was built. You know, a lot of those materials have what they call a 50-year lifespan, what they expect to get, that's how many years they expect to get out of those projects that they did. And that time has come and gone. 50 years has come and gone. And so it was inevitable that something would break. And I just want to make sure the rest of the spillway or the rest of the dam is safe and is in good working order. They rebuilt the spillway and it's magnificent and it was very expensive and it's supposed to be state of the art, which is great. But the gates that are on top of the spillway, the release gates, are still those old gates that they originally built with those same old parts. And for me, that seems like a dangerous chance to take that those will not break or something else inside the dam.
You don't live in Oroville anymore, but you're not far. You're about an hour drive away and you still work there and go into town. This clearly has shaped not only you, but your entire community. And Oroville is one of roughly 1,500 dams in California, tens of thousands across the country. What did you learn from this experience that you can share with others in terms of perhaps preparing or being more knowledgeable?
I think that's the most important thing, is being more knowledgeable. A lot of these reports are available to the public online. Doing my own research has been so integral in getting out when we got out, and being prepared. So knowing what is going on with the maintenance of these dams, I think is really important. And especially now being as involved as I am, I really see the importance of the citizens being involved, because the infrastructure has taken a backseat in California. I know, you know, personally, but I'm sure it's like that all over. And really, it's up to the community to make sure that we're safe. I don't think we can rely on anybody else.
And that is Genoa Northern with the Oroville Dam Citizens Advisory Commission, created by the state to take part in operations, maintenance, and overall public safety of Oroville Dam. Genoa's family goes back 3 generations in Oroville. Still ahead, dam safety engineers explain what went wrong and how the Oroville spillway crisis is teaching us about dams across the country. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The Oroville Dam spillway crisis began today in 2017, and with that hindsight of 5 years, we spent the hour learning what went well and what went wrong. We listened to personal stories from the Butte County Sheriff and a longtime Oroville resident turned community activist following the evacuation of nearly 200,000 people downstream. Now we turn to the cause. Or causes. 18 months after that crisis, California Department of Water Resources, DWR, which operates Oroville Dam, reconstructed the primary spillway and strengthened the emergency spillway. But alongside that round-the-clock work, an investigation was also taking place. At the requirement of federal regulators, DWR brought on the country's leading dam and safety engineers to conduct an independent forensic report into the cause of the Oroville spillway crisis. The leader of that forensic team was geotechnical engineer John France. I spoke with John about what he learned, and also with Mark Ogden, with the Association of State Dam Safety Officials, who shares a national view of the country's more than 90,000 dams, a picture that isn't necessarily pretty or sound. John, I want to start with you. You led the independent forensic report on Oroville Dam spillway incident that was released in January of 2018, almost a year after the crisis. Things like this aren't supposed to happen. Why was this problem not foreseen ahead of time?
We could not identify a single root cause, and there were a number of various factors that contributed to it. What triggered the whole incident was the failure of the concrete chute of the service spillway at Oroville Dam. So the structure had operated for many years without a problem. And as we looked back into that, what we realized is it really went back to the very beginning when the project was constructed. And it was constructed with some vulnerabilities in place. In specific, the designer had thought he was designing a spillway on competent rock. There were some problems with the design of the spillway that allowed water to get in under that slab to over time deteriorate the conditions under the slab. And that's what resulted in the slab failing. And although that information was in the files that we were able to find relatively quickly after we started the investigation, no one in the period of time from when the the structure went into operation until the failure happened had recognized those conditions, connected them together, and connected the dots, if you like, and realized the vulnerability of that spillway.
That is surprising because Oroville Dam was nearly 50 years old when this happened, and there are regular inspections that are supposed to take place. So why weren't they aware of this in the nearly 50 years of the dam's existence?
That actually gets to one of the findings in our report also, that to me is one of the more significant findings, is that you're right, the dam was inspected regularly. And it was regulated both by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, and by the state of California. Those inspections that are done on an annual basis typically are someone going out and looking at the structure and seeing whether they see visual evidence of problems with the structure. They don't have X-ray eyes to see what's under that slab and see the conditions that might exist under the slab. So there's only so much you can learn from the physical inspection. And the FERC, the FERC, does require that every 5 years an independent consultant look at those projects and make some assessment of them. And the intention, if you read those regulations by FERC, was that those consultants would look into the history of the project and try to discern whether there were these issues. However, what we found is that that really didn't happen with those five-year inspections that were done. The deep dive into what how the project was constructed, how it would perform, it just wasn't happening as well as it should. And as a result, these latent vulnerabilities of the spillway did not get discovered.
Is a contributing factor the fact that Oroville Dam is part of a massive state water project in California and that there's going to be perhaps slips in oversight?
In my view, I don't think that's necessarily a big part of it. It's a big project. Yes, it's one part of a big project, and that's a resources issue. You need to have the resources to manage that size of project. But certainly Oroville Dam is a big component of that project and one of the key aspects and key parts of that California water project. And I would expect it to get, you know, the attention commensurate with the magnitude of structure it is. And I think it really was a matter of our profession, the dam safety and the dam engineering profession, was relying too much on physical visual inspections indicating problems and not recognizing that we needed to go into this deeper look at how was the thing designed and built, how was it performed, and does that give us any reason to be concerned that it might not continue to perform well.
Oroville Dam is the tallest dam in the country. Did the design contribute to these flaws?
The design did. One of the problems with the design was that there were underdrain pipes underneath of that concrete slab that were supposed to collect any water. These pipes were supposed to collect it and carry it away so it would not uplift the slabs. And unfortunately, what happened with that is when the concrete cured, over top of each one of those drain pipes, a crack developed. And that crack allowed water in. So rather than the pipes collecting water that would have gotten in through other sources, the pipes actually created a pathway for water to get in underneath. And that wasn't recognized over the 50 years of operation, that structural design defect was actually allowing water in and making conditions worse rather than making conditions better.
Mark, I want to bring you in. You helped write the report card for dams as part of the American Society of Civil Engineers. What are the conditions of dams in the country?
Unfortunately, as you mentioned, that report card, it gave dams a grade of D, and that's been a consistent grade over the history of the report card for dams as a category of infrastructure. Specifically, we estimated over 2,300 high hazard potential dams, which are dams that if they were to fail, there'd be a probable loss of life. So we estimate that there's over 2,300 of those that are considered in either poor or unsatisfactory condition. The state dam safety programs are responsible for over 70% for inspecting and regulating over 70% of the almost 92,000 dams in the National Inventory of Dams. And unfortunately, many of the state programs are underfunded. Many have weaker laws and don't have the authority and ability they need to be able to make sure that dams are maintained and operated in a safe manner. The average age is over 50 years for dams throughout the U.S. So a lot of them are aging. A lot of them were built at a time when engineering standards were different and there was not as good of understanding of how to construct a dam, how to design a dam. A lot of them were built out in rural areas where there was nobody downstream and maybe they weren't considered to be as much of a problem. And now development has occurred. So all of these things contribute to that grade of a D. And there are a lot of needs that we're working to address, but they're still out there.
I mean, you're talking about 92,000 dams, roughly 1,500 of which are in the state of California. Were you surprised of what you saw happen at Oroville Dam Spillway?
I think no is probably the answer. Maybe that's a two-part answer for me there, because Oroville is one of the dams that, you know, you would be surprised somewhat to see that there would be an incident occur there. I think that for a lot of the larger dams, more high-profile dams throughout the country, you expect that there are being well-maintained, inspected properly, and you wouldn't expect maybe these type of things to occur. Although, you know, we do know based on what happened at Oroville, subsequent assessments on a lot of larger dams, like with the Corps of Engineers, have found that many of their dams have issues that need to be addressed. So, you know, it's not surprising in that regard, just because we are seeing these things throughout the country. So, yeah, it's kind of a two-part answer to you there, but I you know, we do know that these things happen and they continue to.
I'd like to comment a little bit on the question you just posed to Mark is, I mean, we do say in the report that one of the things that really made this incident an eye-opener was that this was the tallest dam in the United States. It was subject to energy regulation by a federal agency, FERC, and by a state dam safety program that really was regarded as one of the best dam safety programs in the United States. So in that way, it was very surprising to see something like this happen at Oroville. And it's what made us ask the question of, are our best practices good enough? Or do we need to improve our practices? And why we recommended that, yes, we need to improve those practices. We made some suggestions for how those practices could be improved. And what was satisfying to us in that regard is that we're seeing some action on that. California took action in its dam safety program. FERC has taken action in how it's doing its dam safety program. And I think other states did that also. So in that regard, it was surprising, and we're learning from that surprise. And unfortunately, in engineering endeavors, sometimes we learn from incidents and failures.
I want to go back to 2017 when I was covering this, because there was debate surrounding if the spillway did indeed fail, because it didn't entirely cave in and the emergency spillway was effective in terms of protecting lives and property. Is there a nuance with this word failure when it comes to water infrastructure, and in this case, the spillway and the emergency spillway?
I think there is. And we were careful in our report. The report is about the spillway incident, not the spillway failure. And the only thing that we used the word failure for was the spillway chute, that we clearly had a spillway, concrete spillway chute failure. But we did not have a dam failure as it's defined in the dam safety practice, which is a failure of a structure to release part of the stored reservoir water. When the erosion started to happen downstream of the emergency spillway, it was not clear whether that erosion, had it continued, would have failed that structure and released the reservoir. And to this day, we probably don't know whether that would have happened. So there is nuance in the word failure. You can talk about a failure of a component of a structure, or you can talk about the failure of the entire structure function of storing the water. The second didn't happen, the first did.
Finally, I can't help but think about the nearly 200,000 people that had to evacuate downstream. And after this conversation, we know the state of dams are getting, you know, a grade of a D. And over the last 20 years, the number of high hazard potential dams has more than doubled. There are 1,500 here in California. Mark, what are some things the public can do to prepare for an emergency like this in the future?
It is important, I think, that people know if they live in the area near a dam and what they might need to do if there would be an emergency situation with that dam. Talk to your local emergency officials, find out if there is an evacuation plan and what you would need to do in that situation. Our association developed materials that would be helpful to people to help understand better this if they live in an area of a dam. You can go to livingneardams.org and see the publications there. And if there's a dam in your area that's not up to standards, doesn't have an emergency action plan, talk to the regulatory officials and make sure that they're working to make that happen.
That is Mark Ogden with the Association of State Dam Safety Officials, sharing a national view of the country's more than 90,000 dams, and John France, who was the lead investigator of an independent forensic report on the Oroville Dam spillway crisis. We also have a link to the website livingneardams.org for more information. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Nick Dobis, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.